This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 3 years after the attack on the World Trade Center, my guest Paul Goldberger has published a new book called Up From Zero, about the architectural, political, and emotional debates surrounding the rebuilding of this site, which is now considered sacred ground. Goldberger is the architecture critic for The New Yorker. In his book, he writes, "There is no instruction manual to tell a city what to do when its tallest buildings are suddenly gone and there is a void in its heart." About 2 months after September 11th, Governor Pataki established the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation and charged it with overseeing the rebuilding process. In the summer of 2002, the LMDC unveiled 6 plans for Ground Zero. But at a public meeting that July, attended by about 4,000 people, each of the 6 plans was voted poor or unacceptable. The LMDC got the message and responded by opening a competition for a new site plan. I asked Paul Goldberger to describe the plans that evoked such a negative response at the town meeting.
The original design was never really even architecture. It was much more of just a series of studies to try to figure out whether you could put back 10 million square feet of office space, which is what the World Trade Center towers contained, but do it not with two 110-story buildings, whether you could combine that with a memorial, with public open space, with putting back some of the streets that had been there before the original World Trade Center was built, because the original World Trade Center was on a 16-acre site that had once been a whole bunch of Lower Manhattan blocks. They were all cleared away for a huge concrete plaza on which the original World Trade Center towers were placed. Well, we've learned a lot about cities in the years since the Trade Center was built. And by now, nobody really likes doing it that way anymore. We realize that there's, in fact, a great deal of joy and life and energy to a real city street. They said to an architectural firm named Beyer Blinder Bell, who they had hired to do their initial studies, just do a few schemes for us that show us how to put back all these square feet of office space and some stores and commercial space and a memorial and the streets. And let's just see if it's possible. And they came up with 6 versions. And it looked very clunky and conventional. And what people were most offended by was the fact that the whole thing seemed to be driven by a bunch of commercial concerns. And it seemed to be a lot of office buildings with a little memorial plunked down in the middle. And it seemed particularly to family members, who many of whom had objected initially to building anything at all on the site, felt a little patronizing to them, felt as if they had been tossed a kind of memorial bone to quiet them down, and that the real goal of that initial study was simply to get a lot of profit-making office space back so Larry Silverstein and the Port Authority would have their office buildings once again and could start, you know, churning out the cash.
So when at this public meeting, the public that was in attendance decided they hated this plan and
yes.
objected to it, in part because it was too commercial. And so that plan was scratched. When that plan was scratched, was there also a commitment to making Ground Zero not as about commercial office space as the original plan was?
What happened was a very clever attempt to change the system and not change the system at the same time. The governor, who was really the most powerful person in this entire process, Governor Pataki, did not want to go back on his commitment to the Port Authority and to Larry Silverstein that they would be entitled to rebuild all of the office space that had been destroyed on 9/11. However, he very much wanted to give the public the impression that the priorities were elsewhere. So the architects who were brought in to participate in the next round, when Beyer Blinder Bell was sort of shown the door, and the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation decided that the way to improve the whole situation was to bring in architects of international renown so that they could not be accused of being not sufficiently interested in architecture. And they said that, you know, the memorial must be the sort of real center and the driving force of the project, and there must be public space, and there must be a lot of other important things that were not in the earlier plans or not very effectively in the earlier plans. But in fact, the fundamental commercial reality never really changed. Architecture was being used, in effect, as a kind of window dressing so that the thought was if we had better buildings done by famous architects, maybe people wouldn't notice that there was still a commercial driving force behind this project, and we were still trying to cram in more office space than there really was going to be room for.
And in a way, wasn't the goal at this point to make the design of the office building a monument itself, so that the container of these offices would have the emotional impact of a giant skyscraper-like monument?
Right. There was a request in the sort of assignment given to these architects to create some kind of powerful skyline element. Because I think was a very wise and important component of this whole thing. The Lower Manhattan Development Corporation people understood a critical thing, which is that so many people desperately missed the skyline. Those who were lucky enough not to have actually lost family members or loved ones on 9/11 also felt they had lost something very close to themselves, and that was the skyline itself. And I found that very moving, and the goal of restoring that in some way by building something very tall was a very convincing and important one. The problem, of course, is that who wants at this moment in history to have an office or an apartment or anything else on the 110th floor on exactly that site? And so the idea of just a great tower kind of began to be out in the air. I suggested it at some talk I gave in one of the many sort of symposiums and panels and stuff that happened in those months, that we think in terms of a great symbolic tower, sort of the Eiffel Tower of the 21st century, that could use the latest technology to do something new in the sky that would be a very beautiful form and symbol, but would not be office space because there was really no market for that right now. As it turned out, the plan that Daniel Libeskind evolved with the so-called Freedom Tower kind of combined that idea with a smaller office building that would have a huge symbolic spire that would come up out of it, so that the office building itself would be maybe 60 stories tall, not much more than half the height of the old World Trade Center, but then an unusual symbolic spire would keep going and in fact would be quite a bit taller than the old World Trade Center and would sort of restore the sense of something, a punctuation mark on the skyline that way.
And Daniel Libeskind, in fact, won the competition for the plan. Would you describe his design a little bit more and how he wanted it to resonate with the Statue of Liberty?
Sure. Daniel Libeskind's design, which he originally called Gardens of the World because he imagined that that spire would have a whole bunch of gardens in the sky representing international flora of different kinds. And then later it was changed to the 1776 tower because it was to be 1,776 feet tall. And then Governor Pataki began to call it the Freedom Tower, and that stuck, and so it's actually known as the Freedom Tower now. His notion was that he would do this office building that would be largely of glass, somewhat asymmetrical and angular, which is how Libeskind's architecture tends to be. And then it would have this great spire rising off one side of it, and he likened it to the Statue of Liberty with the raised arm, and in fact even showed images from out in New York Harbor where you saw the Statue of Liberty in the foreground, and then beyond, he, with computerized technology, sort of imposed his building into the existing skyline, and you saw that same form, the spire, kind of like the upraised arm. Libeskind has a tendency, he's a very good architect, but he has a tendency often to describe his work with metaphors that are very traditional, even a little bit sappy and conventional sometimes. And it's sort of an unusual combination of avant-garde work that is presented in very traditional sort of apple pie terms. I think I said in the book that it's sort of as if, you know, you had a had John Cage trying to sell his music as if it were Irving Berlin. that's kind of what Libeskind does. So, in fact, that whole Statue of Liberty thing, it got a lot of people interested. It made it seem very appealing. But, in fact, I don't know that you would really ever perceive that building in conjunction with the Statue of Liberty in quite that way anyhow.
So, although Daniel Libeskind won the competition for the plan to rebuild Ground Zero, he's not exactly rebuilding with that design. He was basically forced to collaborate with another architect, David Childs, who didn't share the same vision. How did that end up happening?
Libeskind had never really won the right to design any buildings. What the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation did when it asked numerous architects from around the world to submit master plans was ask them to design a layout for Ground Zero, to decide what should go here, what should go there, where the memorial should go, to create the basic outlines for the site. All of those architects responded with more than they were actually asked to do. And they understood that the public, of course, doesn't want to look at little maps with streets here and there. The public wants to look at images and pictures of real things. And so Libeskind and all the other architects responded with what were really ideas for real buildings, and including Libeskind's Freedom Tower idea. Well, the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation's position was that all was very nice and perfectly fine, and they, in accepting and choosing Libeskind's design, they were accepting and choosing the notion of a very tall tower, the Freedom Tower, in that location, but not the specifics of his actual design. And Larry Silverstein, the real estate developer who had leased the original World Trade Center towers and who was going to control the insurance proceeds from this, so he was a pretty powerful fellow in this process still because he had the money to rebuild. Silverstein said, well, you know, I think I accept the master plan, and I think Daniel Libeskind has done a beautiful site plan for Ground Zero, and that's where we'll put the tower and all that. But the actual design of the tower, I mean, this is just a sketch. And I want my architect, who is David Childs of the firm of Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, I want him to design the tower, not this guy who is inexperienced in skyscrapers anyway, and just did a sketch. And Libeskind said, absolutely not. The governor stood in front of a 6-foot-tall banner of Libeskind's sketch and said, I pledge to start this building in the summer of 2004. We will break ground and we are moving ahead and so forth. And Libeskind's position was, well, the governor committed to building my building, and so I have the right to turn these sketches into a real finished buildable design. And it was a pretty rough time. In the summer of 2003, it all came to a head. Libeskind thought he was doing the skyscraper. David Childs thought he was doing the skyscraper. The governor said that he just wanted this situation worked out and ordered the two architects to work together. Now, they were not too happy working together because, I mean, imagine if you'd asked, I don't know, you know, Salvador Dali and Picasso to paint a picture together. You know, they don't necessarily have the same ideas. So I don't think you would have gotten the highest of either man's art.
My guest is Paul Goldberger, architecture critic for The New Yorker magazine and author of the new book Up From Zero about the debates surrounding the rebuilding of Ground Zero. Two voices in that debate are Daniel Libeskind, the architect who won a competition to design the master plan for the site, and David Childs, the architect selected by the Trade Center's landlord, Larry Silverstein, to design a skyscraper where the Twin Towers had stood. The clashes between them is the focus of a Frontline documentary called Sacred Ground, which airs tonight on PBS. Goldberger is featured in the film. Before we get back to my interview with him, here's a clip from Sacred Ground in which Daniel Libeskind and David Childs are describing the problems with their collaboration.
And he said, well, my tower is already perfect. It doesn't need any help from you, Mr. Libeskind. It doesn't. You have some great ideas here, but my tower is perfect. So I said, well, what is the collaboration? He said, you can comment on it.
Collaborators, you think of a man and a wife, or two people that are equal, two hands working together. And that they were two equals. It wasn't. There would be a design architect. It was very different. And that must be me. But there could be 10 outstanding items, and I may vote that my 51% opposite to your 49 on all 10 of them. You understand that, Danny? And that's how we're, and he said, absolutely, I understand. And we again shook each other's hand, looked each other in the eye.
David Childs had his own vision for what the architecture at Ground Zero should be. And he wanted to build his design, not the design from Daniel Libeskind. So what was David Childs' vision for what the architecture should be?
David Childs had actually been playing with ideas for very tall skyscrapers at Ground Zero since right after 9/11. You know, he had had a close tie to Larry Silverstein for a while. He had actually been hired by Silverstein to look into ways to fix up the World Trade Center and improve it in the summer of 2001. And then 9/11 happened, and soon thereafter, Childs began to do some studies for new towers there at Silverstein's request in some cases. Some of them he just did on his own. And he'd been playing with that for a very long time. He had an idea for a sort of single torqued or slightly twisted tower that in fact would be offices at the bottom and then would culminate in a purely symbolic spire coming off the top, but felt very strongly that the spire should rise out of the center of it. Libeskind wanted a more angular building, not something with a sort of slightly curving twist to it, and also felt adamant that the spire be on the side. So they had some pretty fundamental differences. They also did not get along terribly well personally. Childs is a very, very experienced designer of skyscrapers and former chairman and one of the chief partners in Skidmore, Owings & Merrill, which is one of the largest and most powerful and most experienced skyscraper design firms in the world. Daniel Libeskind ran a small atelier kind of office that had mainly done museums up to now and had very little experience with very large commercial buildings. Childs thought Libeskind was kind of a little pushy and ambitious. Libeskind thought Childs was arrogant and condescending, and it was not a happy combination.
So what kind of hybrid do we have now? What is actually moving forward?
Well, at the Freedom Tower, which is still going ahead in Libeskind's preferred site at the northwest corner of Ground Zero, Libeskind and David Childs ended up with a kind of hybrid of their two ideas. It's not the best of either architect. The base is sort of a little more like Childs in a slightly twisted and torqued form. The spire is asymmetrical as Libeskind wanted it, but it's a short, stubby, asymmetrical spire that comes out of a whole interesting cable structure that's at the top that is fills the whole top of the building, is kind of almost like an empty mesh of cables that were done in significant part by the engineers Guy Battle and Guy Nordenson, who had worked at different times with David Childs on it, and which it was hoped would sort of represent the cables of the Brooklyn Bridge and evoke that, and which are supposed to have windmills and create a kind of wind farm of energy there, bringing new sources of energy and allowing the building to be a symbol of alternative and environmental responsibility, we might say. While they did have a symbolic groundbreaking on the 4th of July, which was what the governor had pledged to do, and set in place a really very beautiful stone commemorating those who died on September 11th, which is to be the cornerstone of the building, the reality is they're still struggling over elements of that building. They're not ready to really go whole hog into building it. And I'm not sure what the final version is actually going to look like. For all that we have seen this hybrid for all it's been publicly announced and hailed by the governor as the, you know, greatest thing since the Empire State Building or whatever, it's still evolving and changing. And I don't know whether it's going to go more in the Libeskind direction or more in the David Childs direction. I sort of hope it goes in one or the other, because what we've got now is a kind of awkward hybrid that doesn't have the greatest strengths of either one.
Now, we've discussed the architecture plans for the office space, for the major building that will be at Ground Zero. There's also a monument that will be part of it, and there's yet another designer involved with that, or a couple of other designers involved with that. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What is the latest plan for the actual monument?
Well, the memorial itself, there was a separate process for. And the Lower Manhattan Development Corporation held a competition, and they said this is going to be a real, true competition, and we're going to have some judges. They're going to pick the best design. They're all going to be anonymous so that we can do it purely on the basis of quality. And they ended up with a design by a young architect named Michael Arad, who didn't particularly like the Libeskind plan and kind of struggled with another. One aspect of the Libeskind plan we haven't talked about is the fact that in his master plan, he called for depressing the entire site of the original footprint of the World Trade Center and having the memorial a little bit below grade. Arad changed that completely, raised it to ground level, and wanted only the actual footprints of the towers, the two squares where the towers had been, to be sunken. And that was chosen, so that made for a big change in Libeskind's master plan.
And another thing that Libeskind wanted was to have the slurry wall, the wall that survived the attack at the World Trade Center, and this is the wall that kept the river out mm-hmm. of the building. He wanted that to survive as part of a monument so that we'd have a ruin from the building
yes.
that we
yes,
could visit and use
mm-hmm.
to reflect upon. But that, I think, is no longer part of the plan.
Well, actually, it is sort of part of the plan, but it's kind of been shunted off to the side and made very marginal because it doesn't really fit with raising everything to street level. However, they will keep that ruined wall that survived from the foundation of the old World Trade Center sort of exposed. You won't see it from outside, from the street. You can kind of go down underground, and then you'll see it. So it's a sort of weak compromise of Libeskind's plan. It's kind of another case in which Libeskind's ideas, just as in the Freedom Tower, are sort of there, but have now been so compromised by having to combine them with a different architect's vision that they're not quite there in the original way. On the other hand, Michael Arad's plan for the memorial was the best of the competitors, I think, and it did deserve to win. The problem is it won by changing a key part of the master plan, and that's kind of tough. On that one, by the way, Libeskind has been very generous and cooperative, unlike with the Freedom Tower, where they've had a very public struggle. I guess he decided he didn't want any more public fights, so he and Arad have been working hard to try to make things work okay.
Is it too soon to project a completion date for Ground Zero?
Well, it's at least 10 to 15 years away, because there's another factor we haven't even talked about yet, which is that there's not really much of a demand for office space there. What people want now in Lower Manhattan is housing. Before September 11th, it was becoming more and more of a mixed-use residential neighborhood, less the total financial district that it used to be, much more a place where people lived, had restaurants, stores, cultural facilities, things like that. A lot has been going on in that neighborhood before September 11th. What will save that neighborhood ultimately will be a continuation of all those same forces, a continuation of all the forces that were at play in Lower Manhattan on September the 10th. And the determination of the authorities to keep the actual Ground Zero site for office buildings primarily, with a little bit of cultural facilities and memorial, means that it doesn't respond quite enough to all these forces. Not having housing when the demand for housing is high and the demand for offices is low means that it's going to take even longer to finish the place up, because a lot of those buildings are only going to be built when there's actually a market demand for them. And there really isn't much now. There isn't even much of a demand for the Freedom Tower. The governor said he'll move in, but there's still, okay, he'll take a floor, but we've got about another 60 more to fill.
At the beginning of our conversation, you talked a little bit about the role of the public in deciding what the future of Ground Zero would be. What are some of the conclusions you've reached about, as you put it, the difficulty of architecture as a form of participatory democracy?
It's interesting because I totally believe that the involvement of the public has been critical here. And it could not have been any other way anyway, because how could you take a site like this that everybody feels such a deep emotional connection to and cut the public out of it? And yet, on the other hand, architecture doesn't always make for very good participatory democracy. People will not necessarily pick the best thing. It's important to remember that all the way through this process, at various times with various polls, none of them showed less than, if I recall correctly, 30 or 40% of people wanted to rebuild the old World Trade Center. Now, you know, to spend billions of dollars to recreate one of the great architectural mistakes of the 20th century would not have been particularly wise, in my view. It would have denied everything we have learned about architecture and building since then. It would have also been a huge act of public denial, and that it would have pretended that nothing had happened. And so it's a tough thing. How do you bring in the public, listen to their views, but not put the thing up to a referendum? I don't think putting art up to a referendum particularly gets you very far most of the time. And also people tend to be a little bit afraid of the new and not to support it until it's a little bit more familiar. But here is a case in which, in fact, the new is what will serve us the best, I think, is to look forward as much as we possibly can here and show the world on this piece of land in which America was attacked, show the world that America not only rebuilds, but remains at the cutting edge of creativity.
Well, Paul Goldberger, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Paul Goldberger is the author of the new book, Up From Zero. He's also featured in the Frontline documentary, Sacred Ground, which airs tonight on many PBS stations.